Hello everyone and welcome to today's podcast. My name is Johan and I'm also known as Mr. Moth online, especially on Twitter. And this podcast will be called, I don't know, the Mothcast maybe, until I come up with a better name. Today I would like to talk to you about two areas which I find very interesting. That is language and history, and I'm actually becoming a teacher in English and history, so I should know about this stuff. The topic is more specifically words, and the two words are terrorism and genocide, and I want to talk a little bit about the usage of those words and the history behind them. And we generally use language without much thought or reflection, right? We just assume that our intentions are pretty clear and that the words we use have stable and obvious meanings. But we have also all experienced being misunderstood and feeling that something has been lost in translation when we want to communicate. On the internet, this often happens when you write something and the other person doesn't see the sarcasm and they think you're really stupid and you get into an argument or something. Or when you use different accents or different sort of social speaking codes, this can sometimes cause confusion. However, when we use the same word to mean basically the same thing, we expect that it is at least somewhat consistent. However, the meaning of words tends to change over time and over context. Sometimes they change quite radically. For example, the word anti-Semitism is today quite unambiguously negative, and it implies hostility towards Jews. While some people may would argue that it is used too rarely or too often, some people would probably not argue that the word itself is bad, right? That isn't very common. However, the word was originally used to self-designate for people who identified as anti-Semites. They had ideas based on racial theories that divided Jews into Semites as opposed to Aryans. That's where the word comes from. It's anti-Semites. The word was preferable in their eyes to other words, like, for example, Judenhass, which means Jew hate, because it isn't obviously hateful, and it sounds more scientific. It makes it easier for them to say, you know, we don't really hate Jews as people. We just have some concerns about foreign racial and cultural groups displacing the original inhabitants of Germany or something like that. Worth noting is also that the concept of Semites as a people group is discredited, and it is only used in language studies when we talk about the Semitic language group, which includes Hebrew, Arabic, Amharic, and Assyrian, and a few others. And a lot of people would also say that when you write the word anti-Semites, you shouldn't write it anti-Semite. You should write it anti-Semite, because there is no Semite to be anti, because that is a false concept. But anyway, let's move on. Another word that has had a change of meaning over the years is the word barbarian. Nowadays, it's generally used as sort of a synonym for maybe someone who does something very cruel or someone who is very unpolite or maybe doesn't wash. However, the original word comes from the meaning of, you know, it's just someone who doesn't speak Greek, because the Greeks thought other people sounded like bar, 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 bar when they spoke. And funnily enough, this included Latin, which is probably the least barbaric language you could imagine. However, I remember reading history texts about an author who had translated his play into the barbaric language. And the barbaric language was Latin, because, you know, the Latins weren't civilized enough. The words also has some, you know, sinister underlying meaning when you think of it like this, because it just doesn't mean cruel or uncomplicated. It also means, like, you know, what the dirty foreigners do over there. And, you know, what those people do. We're not like that. We're Greeks. We can't be barbarian. Only the barbarians do that stuff. So it sort of cordons off who can be a barbarian. It's only an outsider who can be a barbarian. And that's kind of why I'm careful with the word, even though people probably don't know this. And people just use it to mean, you know, bad or maybe a bit simple or something like that. But the word has roots in basically a pretty sort of maybe not racist, but xenophobic idea that basically outsiders are barbarian. Another word that I want to talk about, and one of the main words, is terrorism, which has almost always been controversial when you use it. Even within the halls of the US government, different agencies use different definitions, which is quite interesting. Originally, this was coined as a descriptor for state oppression. And it's today mainly used to describe non-state actors like militias or small groups or cells or so-called lone wolves. The word is used to signify people who are irrational, fanatic, extremely fanatic, and who is so evil that you can never have a conversation with them. You know, people in movies often say, "We do not negotiate with terrorists," which was also like official state policy of America, that they would not negotiate with terrorists. However, people sometimes do negotiate with terrorists, like in Northern Ireland, for example, where it was quite successful, I would say. Even if the definition of terrorist doesn't fit with all groups, even if the definition of terrorist listed above is not always inaccurate, terrorism is still a label that is more frequently being applied to a broad swath of groups, like small insurgent groups, like communist guerrillas, like maybe an indigenous rights group or a self-defense group, or maybe even like criminal syndicates, like street gangs, or maybe even, very worryingly, political opponents. This is especially ominous since terrorism sort of allows the government to treat people as, you know, enemy combatants is the term used. And this is used to avoid treating them as someone that can be taken as a prisoner of war, that can be have prisoner of war status. So if you just call them enemy combatant, you consider them not eligible to be a prisoner of war. So terrorism is a very convenient word to use when you don't really want to contend with the actual positions of your political opponent. So dictatorships have used this for a very long time, calling opponents terrorists, whether they use political violence or not. This is nothing new. It's more new in democracies. This sort of trend started to gain traction after 9/11, especially when terrorism had become a top priority for America. And also after the 7/7 attacks, it became a big topic in Europe as well. So in China, they pointed out the Uyghurs who fought for independence as terrorists. And Turkey also said that the Kurdish PKK was terrorists. So those groups were considered terrorists by America. My contention is not that these groups have not committed acts of violence that can be legitimately called terrorism. The PKK has done a lot of horrible things. There are Chinese Uyghur groups that has committed acts of just brutal terrorism. But terrorism is very easy to oppose, while fighting for national self-determination is a much harder argument to have. You know, it's a lot easier to say that the Uyghurs are terrorists and therefore what we're doing towards them is okay, rather than say they should not have a national self-determination. So you just avoid that topic altogether. And the word terrorism is used based on the perspective of the user most of the time. Like violence against Americans in American media is almost always called terrorism. Maybe not if it's against Russians, or if it's against Uzbeks, or if it's against Chinese people, or if it's against Africans. And this is not unique to America. The same is true for Israeli media, Egyptian media, and British media. The IRA word terrorists, and a soldier shooting a civilian is not necessarily a terrorist in the eyes of the media in this sense. And the word terrorism has also been starting to be used like, the word terrorism has also been used to refer to more or less non-violent or groups that use a minimum of violence in like self-defense, like anti-fascist action or Black Lives Matter, who have been branded with the word terrorist. And this allows, again, the state to avoid the problems that these groups point out and that they fight against, and instead just call them irrational, insane evildoers that we should have, you know, no conversation with. But even if the word is often misused, terrorism undeniably is a thing that exists, like people attack civilians. What should we call it then if terrorism isn't a good word? Well, I don't really have a conclusive answer, as you might have guessed. But I guess we could start by, you know, not describing entire groups or entire, you know, movements as terrorist groups, but rather just say, okay, this was an act of terrorism. And I mean, like, the US engages in terrorist tactics sometimes. That doesn't mean, at least in my view, that the entire United States is a terror state. I know people might disagree, but this is my podcast. So. The common adage, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, also shows that this is not a new idea. Like, you have heard this a lot of times. You know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And it's often, you know, people like Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist until, I think, 2008 by America. Until he was seen as, you know, the hero that ended apartheid. So the word is not always that clearly used. Like, it moves a lot. Both states and non-state actors also carry out acts against targets that affect civilians or the target civilians with the intention of spreading fear or achieving other political aims. And most warring factions probably engage in this to some extent. So I think, therefore, it's very hard to say, okay, this group engages in terrorism. Well, every group that is engaged in warfare probably to some extent or other target civilians, or at least affect civilians. So I think it's more useful just to focus on the thing being done as the act of terrorism and describe the groups in a more objective way. So that was the first word. Let's move on to our second topic, which is the word genocide. And the word genocide has generated a discussion from its very inception and since it was enshrined to international law following World War II. While the Holocaust fits very well into the definition of genocide, other genocides has constantly been fought over if they are to be included. For example, the Armenian genocide is considered a genocide by most scholars, and it's pretty uncontroversial. But political pressure from the Turkish government and its political allies have often made it so that a lot of people just don't call it a genocide. The Holodomor, the famine in Ukraine, is also controversial, as well as the Srebrenica genocide, that is also questioned by some people, From the beginning of the use of the word genocide has been, not very useful. In my view, there has also always been a lot of holes in the definition, and one of those holes is the fact that if you target a specific political group, that may be another crime against humanity, but it isn't considered an act of genocide. The Convention Against Genocide was signed in 1948, which means that Stalin was still alive and very much engaged in things, or had at least engaged in things that could be considered genocide. So he and the rest of the Soviet Union, to make sure that their actions did not constitute genocide according to this convention, they were instead very careful to try to make it so that acts of colonial repression or racial discrimination were counted as genocide. And the Americans, of course, and the Western allies tried to get it in the other direction so that the things they were engaged in did not count. And an example of the success of this is that, for example, the forced relocation of Aboriginal children in Australia and the so-called Lost Generations, that would be considered an act of genocide, for example. But the definition of genocide does not include cultural genocide, what we might call cultural genocide. It isn't actually in the definition. And the guy who invented the term, Lemkin, was not happy with this. He wanted to include it. And today, when we speak of genocide generally, we often include destruction of culture. So the politicization of the definition of genocide made it very difficult for anyone to prosecute someone for genocide. But might that include something that we have done? So they'd rather not prosecute. But since the Cold War, there has been some prosecutions of genocides committed in the Yugoslav wars as well as Rwanda. So that's at least a step forward. The concept of genocide also manages to be both very, very expansive, as well as sort of cut out a lot of things that we might consider genocide in everyday speech. One of those things that weren't included for a long time was so-called genocidal rape, but it is now included in the definition. And also, like mass killings of political opponents, like for example in Indonesia, the regime killed a lot of communists, that technically doesn't count as genocide. Or in the Soviet Union, where political dissidents may be disappeared and things like that, that didn't count as genocide either. But this sort of loophole made it so that you could just say that, well, this population of, let's say, Rohingya, they're not really persecuted for being Rohingya. They're persecuted for being terrorists and supporting terrorism. It isn't really genocide if we persecute them for political reasons. So here again, the word terrorism is used to justify acts of genocide. And that also happens in China with the Uyghur population. And I don't know whether to call that genocide yet, but let's hope it doesn't come to that. And it is also important to recognize that genocide doesn't only include things that are directly violent. It also involves like indirect actions that sort of lead towards the extinction or the attempted extinction of other people. Like depriving them of health care, depriving them of food, or forcing them to sterilize. And forced sterilization has happened in a lot of countries, even countries we would consider, humanitarian, like Sweden, for example, had a very dark history of this. So, in conclusion, our usual use of the word genocide, and the real definition used by the UN, they don't always sort of coincide. Like we may We may call the Cambodian killing fields and that thing a genocide, but most of the people killed were Khmers, the majority ethnic group, and they were killing mostly other Khmers for being, intellectuals or sort of politically against the leadership, often called, Khmers with Vietnamese brains, they would say, for example. And there were also actions against ethnic Vietnamese, for example. So there were a lot of killing on ethnic grounds as well. But should we really call it a genocide then? Or does that not really matter? Well, this is one of the very main contentions I have with the way we often use genocide as just a catch-all for big crimes. The coiner of the word, for example, Raphael Lemkin, said those who use the word genocide banalize it into a validation of every kind of victimhood, but those who should use it never let it slip their mouths. So the word is sometimes used for things like slavery, warfare, or acts of general political repression, but it means that genocide is, it's a specific attempt to eradicate a specific group of people. Of course, the other ones are not smaller crimes because they are not that, but they are also not genocides in his view. And would it really make it so bad not to use that word? Maybe we should just invent another word that we can use as a more catch-all term. And reserve the word genocide for more specific events. And another reason why I'm hesitant to use the word genocide is that it has been co-opted a lot by the far right in order to describe the supposed genocide of white South African farmers, which is a myth. There is no genocide against white South African farmers. There is sometimes killings. But they do not constitute a genocide. And an even more far-fetched conspiracy is that Arabs and Africans are diluting European populations and that this somehow constitutes a genocide, something called the Great Replacement, to sound very ominous. This conspiracy has, at minimum, was been the partial inspiration for a large number of anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant terrorist attacks. Recently in New Zealand, and it has also been in America and Norway, for example. And when we talk about language, I generally don't view language as fixed and stable. Like, I don't think there is, well, the UN decided that the definition of genocide was this, 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 and this in 1948, and that's where we stay. I think that language changes. And if we use genocide just to mean a generalized mass murder, and everyone does that, I don't really have an argument against that. But I also think that we could maybe use another word in order to keep genocide a little more precise. Like, for example, the word democide, which just means the killing of a lot of people, which include state killings for any reason. It could be political, for example. But it also sort of includes genocide. So genocides are a type of democide. And I think it's still important to reserve that specific term for an attempt to eradicate a specific group of people, because that sort of crime has its own motivations and sort of connotations. So as you probably realize, the history of the phrase genocide is very complex and has been politicized from the very start. I think it's important to not use it as a catch-all terms for crimes against humanity in general. I think democide is a good substitute for that, because it also includes other kinds of political violence against intellectuals or against political opponents, etc. But I also realized that, the word genocide is way more used than the word democide. And that maybe we have to just, like with the word anti-Semitism, even if I think that the word has, roots that aren't the most descriptive for what it actually is, I still think that maybe we could just use it. But I would like to see that we maybe could be a little more precise than we have been. But that's just a hope. Okay, that was it for today. Thank you very much for listening to me. I have been doing some research by reading parts of Blood and Soil by Ben Kiernan that I would recommend. I've read quite a small section of it because it's a very big book that has a lot of information about genocide and different genocides. I have also read an ebook called The Ethics of Terrorism and Counterterrorism that discusses the word terrorism a little more in depth. I also have a few articles and such as sources that you could look up. All right, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.